Okay, so what I want to talk about is the modeling of a particular kind of flame, non-premixed turbine flames, that are far from chemical equilibrium. I'm not going to talk about this. We're going to focus on one extremely good series of experiments performed at Sandia National Labs a couple of years ago, and talk about our modeling studies of that based on PDF methods, and then discuss the results at the end. So the objective of this modeling exercise is to provide a tractable quantitative theory or model that can be used to calculate quantities of interest and practical relevance in these flows. I've already said that it's a hard problem. Historically, these non-premixed flames have been treated through a succession of easier problems. So the easiest one to deal with is a near equilibrium flame. That is where locally the thermochemical state of the fluid is close to equilibrium, in which case the problem boils down to one of turbine mixing. Okay? So models that were successful treating such relatively simple flames appeared in the 1970s, and to an extent that's a solved problem. Then we can talk about the next hardest problem, which would be small departures from equilibrium. But what I'm going to talk about today is substantial departures from equilibrium, you know, the hard case.
Can you just mention a couple of the quantities of practical interest to calculate?
Well, it depends on the application. For example, I deal a lot with gas turbine combustions, and there the important quantities to calculate would be the temperature profiles. One thing about combustion is you don't have to worry too much about burning the stuff because it really wants to burn, so that's not the consideration. But to gear the flow field to get a good temperature profile at the exit, you want to first approximation, you want a uniform temperature profile so that the turbine blades see a uniform temperature, so you can go to the higher mean temperature. But then, very importantly, are species to calculate the species concentrations. We want the fuel to burn to CO2 and H2O, but of course there are many other species that are produced, and some of these are pollutants, like NO and CO. Those are two primary ones, in the gas phase at least, that people want to be able to calculate. So let me describe the experiment. As I say, this experiment was performed at Sandia National Labs by Barlow and Frank, reported at the last combustion symposium. And here's a picture of the flame that they used. And there's a central jet here, and the fuel comes out actually vertically up. And the fuel is methane mixed with some air. And then there's an annular pilot. You can see the little pilot flames burning. So this is to stop the flame blowing off. And then there's a co-flow of air. And laser diagnostics are used to measure species point-wise through this flame. And the reason that the air is introduced is that that stops the flame from sooting, and soot would interfere with the laser diagnostics. This is a very well-constructed experiment, or series of experiments. And the basic parameter that is varied is the jet velocity. So they studied a whole bunch of flames which they labeled A, B, C, D, E, and F, okay? And they're going in increasing jet velocity. So here is flame D, here is flame F, Reynolds number of about 20,000, 40,000, and here are the jet velocities, so the velocity doubles from here to here. And the point about combustion is that chemical reactions take a certain length of time to occur, and there is a time scale associated with the flow. And if the flow time scale is too small, then there isn't enough time for the combustion to take place, and it won't take place. So the flame will extinguish or blow out. And this is about the highest velocity you can go to without the flame blowing out. So what is interesting to see is the amount of local extinction, the amount of lack of combustion increasing as the velocity in this flame increases.
Can you tell us why the pilot is putting down and what chooses its choice of parameter for the velocity of the pilot?
So if you didn't have a pilot, then it would look just like a simple jet. The primary, in simple flame theory, the primary quantity that would determine whether a flame would extinguish or not would be the scalar dissipation rate. The simple jet in the self-similar region, the scalar dissipation rate goes down like x to the minus 4. So in other words, it is greatest right near the nozzle. Okay? So if you don't have a pilot, then extinction and blowout would occur at the same time. So you cannot study extinction, local extinction, partial extinction in an unpiloted flame. So the pilot is there so that you can have a little bit of extinction without having the flame blow off. I should say that the design, this burner was designed basically by Bob Bilger, University of Sydney, and it's been extremely useful. It was very carefully designed for this purpose, so you could study local extinction. Because that is really the interesting thing, because it's where the time scale of the chemistry is comparable to the time scale of the turbines, and the two are interacting most strongly. And also, I should mention that this is not the first experiment. There's been a decade of experiments on this kind of rig, but it's taken a decade really to get the quality of measurements that's needed for what we're going to talk about.
What is the coflow?
This is there's a coflow of air coming up here. Okay, it's three streams: jet, pilot, coflow. Okay, so this is an example of some of the type of measurements that are made. Let's just look at this bottom plot. This is a scatter plot. Each blue dot here represents a laser shot. Okay, they fire the laser and they see what comes off and they figure out all the species that are there in the probe volume. And across here is mixture fraction. If you're not familiar with mixture fraction, you can think of it as a normalized carbon atom concentration. So a mixture fraction of 1 means that the fluid you're looking at is pure fuel. If it's 0, it means it's pure air. And if it's in between, it's basically telling you how much that fluid is mixed between air and fuel. Okay? And there's a band in the middle, which is here for this fuel, that is around stoichiometric, where you have the right proportions of fuel and air to burn completely. Okay, so for this plot, we're showing mixture fraction here and CO, carbon monoxide, here. And this is the furthest location in the flame that they measured, 90 radii downstream. And you can see where the scatter is of these shots. And of course, the scatter is hopefully mostly turbulence, but it is partially, of course, experimental. And then the red line is just the mean through the points. In other words, it's the conditional mean of carbon monoxide conditioned on mixture fraction. And the green line is what one would get in a laminar flame, okay? Which is fairly close to chemical equilibrium. So the point is that the red line and the green line are pretty much on top of each other, indicating that at this location, far downstream, where there's been plenty of time for reaction to take place, then indeed the composition is very close to chemical equilibrium. But then if you work upstream, if you move upstream, 60 radii, 30 and 15, we see a different behavior. Here there's a lot of scatter, okay? Here there's no stuff down here. Here there's plenty of stuff down here, which means that you basically have basically fuel and air mixed without it having reacted, okay, and a lot of scatter. And the red line, again, is the conditional mean. So you can see on this side, the lean side, is quite close to equilibrium, but here it's way, way different, and so on. So there's a lot of local extinction in this in these flames.
The problem one seems to be in the non-catalytic reactions, you consider a lot of tons of regimes and you couldn't find any exception.
I'm sorry, who did this?
Polaron, yeah. And you have a catalytic isothermic reaction.
Uh-huh. Well, this is a different case. Okay.
How many species are actually measured in this experiment? Are you measuring ants and as well in various kinds of radicals?
I don't remember the exact species that were measured. Maybe 10 measured. It gets down to things like OH,
yes.
NO, as well as the major things, CO, CO2, H2O, and N2. So it's not everything, but 10 is pretty good. Okay, so that was basically showing how things change with axial location. This now shows at a given axial location, namely 30 Jeb radii, how things change with the nozzle velocity. So this was the plot we've just been seeing. This is flame F. This is the highest jet velocity. And here's a significant amount of local extinction. Here is half that velocity, much less. And here is an in-between case. Okay, so you can see that as you increase the jet velocity, how the local extinction increases. We wanted to be able to characterize the amount of local extinction by a single number, and that is what these dots represent. The dashed lines give a range of particular interest around stoichiometric, and this is a range that the experimentalists defined. And then the red dot is just a conditional mean of all the samples in that range. And the green dot is the value from the laminar flame at that location. So if the red dot's on top of the green dot, that means you're very close to equilibrium. If the red dot were down here, it would mean there's no combustion at all. So we define a quantity called the burning index as the ratio of the red value divided by the green value. It'll be 1 if it's fully burnt at equilibrium, and it'll be 0 if there's no combustion. So the effect of the jet velocity and axial distance on this burning index is summarized here. So here's axial distance. This is for CO2. You can do this for any species. Here's CO2, here's CO. And this is showing the degree of extinction that is a maximum around here and then decreases as you go downstream in the flame. And then these are for the three flames, F, the highest velocity, D, the lowest, and here's the intermediate one. Okay? So far I've just showed you the experimental data, and the challenge is to be able to calculate these things. So I'm going to show you some calculations based on the PhD work of my student, Jun Chu. And this paper's impressed at combustion and flame. The calculations are made based on the solution of a model transport equation for the joint probability density function of velocity, the thermochemical composition, and the turbulence frequency. This approach has the benefit of having a single, a complete closure in a single model transport equation. If you derive the exact transport equation from the Navier-Stokes and other conservation equations for this PDF, you find that reaction is in closed form, so there's no turbulence modeling that has to be done for the reaction. Convective transport by both the mean and fluctuating velocity also appears in closed form, so that doesn't have to be modeled. The processes that do have to be modeled are molecular processes, due to molecular viscosity, molecular diffusivity, and also quantities to do with the fluctuating pressure. Numerically, this joint PDF is a function of many independent variables. In the case I'm going to show, we had something like 17 composition variables, so if you added up 17 plus 3 plus 1, 21 independent variables. So obviously you can't solve that with a mesh-based method, but it can be solved using a particle method. So that's what we have, a particle mesh method. And the basic representation of the turbulent fluid is in terms of a large number of particles, and each particle has a position, So it's x of t, it has a velocity, u at time t, thermochemical composition phi, and a turbulence frequency, which is purely a model quantity. You can think of the mean of this as like epsilon upon k, giving the rate at which turbulent processes occur. So all the physics is in how the evolution of these quantities is modeled. This is simple, dx dt equals u, so the particles move with their own velocity, which is very important because it is telling you that convection is treated appropriately. The velocity evolves according to the Langevin equation, so we model how the velocity changes following a fluid particle by the Langevin equation. These particles are supposed to be modeling fluid particle properties. The compositions change due to two processes. One is chemical reaction, which can be handled exactly, and the other is molecular diffusion or mixing, and that has to be modeled.
Aspect of putting a stochastic Langevin description into the velocity instead of into the force. Typically you think that the particles responding to the force, which may have some stochastic component, not that the velocity is has a stochastic component.
Well, the you want to look in terms of white noise. The white noise is appears in the velocity equation, so it's the acceleration that is stochastic.
Yes, right. That's the issue. Is that what's happening?
Yes.
Okay. I was just worried that you're putting it into the velocity, but in the acceleration, that's another feature.
Well, let me make sure I said that correctly. Now the Langevin equation we're solving is for the velocity. Writing the stochastic differential equation is something like plus the Wiener process times some coefficient.
So we can think of that as a force, a stochastic mm-hmm. force, right?
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay.
So this is very placement of Navier's curve of Euler, and you will not be discussing how to come from Euler to this equation?
That is right. I will not be discussing that more unless except on request. Okay, so this is giving some more of the details. I've said that we're using the Langevin model to model velocity following fluid particles. The mixing model I won't go into in detail, but it turns out to be very important. The chemistry we handle using a 16-species so-called augmented reduced mechanism. And here are the details of the numerics. We have a 60 by 60 grid, and so we have 60 by 60 arrangement of cells. It's statistically actually symmetric. Within each cell, we have nominally 100 particles. And we're interested in the statistically stationary state, but we march in time until we achieve that, and it takes about 2,000 time steps to achieve that.
So you do the gravity here?
Gravity is not important in this plane.
Why?
Because the Froude number is such that it's not important. If the velocities were lower or the plane were larger, then it would be important. It will have a small effect.
So the viscosity is in the stochastic part of the equation. Where does the molecular viscosity come in?
Nowhere. There are no molecular properties anywhere in the model. It's assumed high Reynolds number kind of assumption that the rate of all mixing occurs at a rate determined by the large scales.
To the extent that the velocity is just modeled by Langevin, how is it different from doing the solving reaction diffusion? The motion of all the scalability is governed by diffusion also, right?
Anyway.
Combustion aside.
Yes.
So should I just think of this as effective AD diffusivity model, and then compare this to solving diffusion equation coupled with solving the reactions?
Well, I don't think it is equivalent to a diffusion. It would be equivalent to diffusion if the time scale were to become very small. But of course,
so the time scale, the larger the tau in diffusion, the
fine.
You will be interested on the time scale smaller than tau?
Sure, those are relevant.
But your dW is still white.
Yes.
What is the permanent frequency of these omegas that you get on previous transparency?
It is purely a model quantity, and the use of it is so that its mean is taken to be the rate at which turbulent processes occur. So in regular turbulence modeling terminology, you can think of it as epsilon upon k, or the omega that Wilcox uses in his k-omega model. So, for example, the mixing occurs at the rate omega, mean omega.
I don't understand the meaning of this Lundgren equation, because I thought that one writes this Lundgren equation in order to describe behavior on a time scale larger than that. I'm dragging you into justifying the use of this Lundgren approximation.
Well, this is a pretty reasonable approximation to the velocity following a fluid particle in let's say homogeneous isotropic turbulence on everything except very small timescale.
So small compared to integral timescale or Kolmogorov timescale?
Except down to the Kolmogorov timescale, it is a good model. If you measure, for example, if you measure Lagrangian velocity autocorrelation functions, then what you see is something that looks like that, very very close to an exponential, and of course this just gives you an exponential. Of course, right at the origin, it can't do this. But no one can measure that height.
Okay.
So apart from when you get down to Kolmogorov scale, this is a very good model. And for inertial range separations, it's consistent with Kolmogorov 41, at least. Oh, in fact, both Kolmogorov, because, anyway, second order Lagrangian structure function is correctly predicted by it. So it's a good model for the velocity following a fluid particle. But the important point of this approach isn't so much the details of how different things are modeled. The important point is you have a representation of the distribution of everything, because you're representing a PDF, basically, or joint PDF. So in particular, you have the distribution of the chemical species through these particles, because each particle has its own set of chemical species. So you're avoiding the averaging in a moment closure approach. Okay, and if there's time and interest, I'll describe later the algorithm used to incorporate the chemistry, because the chemistry, if you do it in the direct way, it is very, very expensive computation, and you basically couldn't do these calculations the direct way. Okay, so let me show you some results of the calculations. These are the boring results, but it's traditional to show profiles. So here are various profiles for one of these flames D. So these are radial profiles as a function of axial distance, 50, 30, 60 radii downstream. The symbols are mean quantities from the experiments. The blue lines are from the calculation. So this is the mean velocity. So as you can see, the center line mean velocity goes down. The jet spreads. So this flame is like a jet, okay? Here is the mean mixture fraction. Again, the center line value falls and it spreads. Velocity variance, mixture fraction variance. and the whole stack of quantities that we can calculate. Let's go to this one. So here are some of the species. Here's CO2, here's CO, here's H2, and here's OH.
What's the comparison between the dots and the blue lines?
The dots are the experimental data, and the blue lines are these PDF calculations. Okay. But that's, it's not that difficult to calculate profiles. It's much more difficult to calculate this stuff. So this is what I showed you at the beginning. So here's the scatter plot of mixture fraction and CO2, and here's mixture fraction and CO, and on the left we have the experiment, and on the right we have what we get from these PDF calculations. Okay? So you can see that in both of these cases we have more or less the same range for the points, and the conditional means. This is the conditional mean through the data, here's the conditional mean through the calculations, and the same for CO. So in the calculations, we have a whole bunch of particles, and so in this case, each blue dot corresponds to the properties of one particle, whereas here it corresponds to one laser shot.
Do you choose tau to vary as per some prescription?
This tau?
Yeah.
No, that's prescribed in the model. If I were to write this, let me try to write this properly. For isotropic turbulence, which isn't what we have, but if we had isotropic turbulence, the full equation would be du equals minus a half plus three quarters C zero epsilon dt plus C zero epsilon to the power half dw. I've got a u here. Okay, so epsilon is the mean dissipation rate, W is the Wiener process, and C0 is a Kolmogorov constant. That's a Kolmogorov constant that appears in the second order Lagrangian structure function. So there's not much freedom here.
So what do you use for C0? What number?
Smaller than the experiments show. Historically, for historical reasons, we're using 2.1, I believe.
Is it very sensitive?
It isn't very sensitive to C0. Before there were any measurements or DNS results for what might be the value of C0, what we did have is Zellman-Warhaft's thermal wake data, spreading of heat behind a line source in grid turbulence. You can apply this model to that and find the value of C0 that predicts the right spreading rate. And that's where the value of 2.1 comes from. But we certainly know now that the Kolmogorov constant is at least 4, I think.
And the boundary conditions on the jet I imposed, the initial velocity of the particles coming out of the jet?
You have the inflow boundary of the jet and the pilot and the co-flow, and you just have to introduce particles appropriately with the appropriate properties. So for example, in the jet we specify something like a fully developed turbine pipe flow velocity profile, and we get the Reynolds stresses from experimental data or somehow have to estimate.
So how many parameters go into this space? How many parameters in the model?
How many adjustable constants? Is that what we're
talking about? Yeah. I mean, these are all. Are there any three parameters that I use in FITS, or are all parameters known from other, fixed by other measurements?
Well, of course, as in all models, there are a whole bunch of constants. This fundamental constant in the velocity equation, the omega equation is very similar to the epsilon equation in standard turbulence modeling, so you've basically got two, well, it's really only one parameter that really matters in that equation, but it's a very important parameter that controls the spreading rates of jets, for example.
Right, but that's fixed by other...
The only one that we studied the variation for in this case was the mixing rate. There's a constant in the mixing model that says how fast the mixing. And it turns out these calculations are very sensitive to that. And that value was chosen for the for this data. And I can show you the sensitivity to that later.
Where does the mixing rate enter? Because I thought that each particle... I'm going to describe the simulation in more detail than I wait.
No. Okay, so we have the particle moves at its own velocity, the Langevin equation for the velocity, and then we have a composition, so that will be d phi dt equals a reaction rate, okay, plus molecular mixing, a model for molecular mixing. Okay, the model we use is very complicated and you can't really write it down as an equation. But to give you a flavor for it, the simplest possible model, which isn't the one we use, would look something like this. It would look like minus a constant, and this is the cost I was talking to you about, times omega, the turbulence rate, times phi minus the local mean. Okay? So just a simple linear relaxation to the local mean.
Okay. How is omega defined?
We have a stochastic model equation for omega, and you can think of the mean of omega as being the same as epsilon upon k.
Without factoring
phi.
But
what
is the equation for the omega involves u somewhere?
It certainly.
Coupling with the velocity u.
It certainly involves. It's like a dissipation equation, it involves production, the production rate. So that comes from the velocity field and the Reynolds stress field.
Epsilon involves u, yes? Or no? And on the top, epsilon is just dissipation.
K times omega.
Here's our
grid, right? And inside each cell we have a whole bunch of particles. Each particle has all the properties. So, for example, we don't do it like this, but for simplicity of explanation, we can get the mean velocity just as the ensemble mean of the velocity of those particles, right? So now we know what the mean velocity is. By subtraction, we know what the fluctuating component of velocity for each particle is. And then we can form the Reynolds stresses, right? So we have the kinetic energy. So we know things like the mean velocity field, we know the Reynolds stress field, we know the kinetic energy field, we know the mean omega field. From that we can get the epsilon field.
And what is the scale of the grid?
This is a one-point closure, so you don't need to resolve anything smaller than the energy-containing kind of scale.
Is there a reason why you choose to write an equation for omega and then back out epsilon rather than the other way around?
I started working with an equation for epsilon. The equation for omega allows for a simpler equation simply because anything that only has dimensions of time, you can write its own equation for it without involving other quantities. On dimensional grounds, you know, you can have an equation, d omega dt equals omega squared times some non-dimensional function. Whereas with epsilon, you have to couple it with the kinetic energy. So, you know, obviously if you can write an equation for omega, you can write the corresponding equation for epsilon. You know, there's always a correspondence. It's just more convenient to write one for omega.
That u is then the Lagrangian mean velocity. You can't believe it. Right.
No. That is then the Eulerian velocity.
Okay.
because it's defined along the Blue Rock-Zinn path, right?
That's right. Okay, so
it's the Eulerian velocity, but it's the Lagrangian mean, right? Because we're taking the average following the parcel, right?
No, the average in
chemistry is not affecting turbulence, right? Or is it?
It certainly is. It's affecting
through each tone in any of those situations.
The strong effect of the combustion on the turbulence is through the density. In combustion, the density typically varies by a factor of 8. On the hot combustion product, have a density of 8th of that of the air. Okay, where that appears in this equation is in the terms I haven't written down.
Well, but if there is no gravity, how density will enter the equation? That's exactly my problem.
It affects it in several ways. One is through the continuity equation. You have a non-zero divergence of velocity. And the other way is through the mean pressure gradient term in this equation. Okay, in this equation, this is written for isotropic turbulence. For inhomogeneous flows, you'll also have the pressure gradient term, minus 1 upon rho. Grad P.
So how does that impact with the pressure? So it's not really a Lagrangian simulation.
No.
It sort of started like Lagrangian simulation, but now you need to really impact the pressure.
Yeah, I mean, if you're thinking historically in terms of turbulent dispersion studies, the Langevin equation has been used for a long time in turbulent dispersion studies where you follow particle trajectories, okay? That's not what we're doing, because we have particles everywhere in our solution domain. So we're simultaneously solving a whole bunch of trajectories, and the reason we're doing that is so at each spatial location we have an ensemble so we can form mean quantities. So it is Lagrangian in the sense that you're following stuff, but you're also able to extract Eulerian means. The pressure, you basically get the density from the equation of state. As far as the thermochemistry is concerned, the pressure is constant. As far as the fluid mechanics is concerned, of course, you have to take into account the pressure variations, and you basically, in principle, you do that by solving the Poisson equation for pressure.
I think one point that should be made is that I think he should be allowed to proceed, because he's not going to ask many of the questions that you might ask of the solution. And then that's the time to really get him, right?
Thank you for rescuing me, but I'm pleased to do this, because the questions I'm answering are more relevant to your interest than the combustion stuff, I think. Okay. All right, so this is this burning index quantity that characterizes how close you are to chemical equilibrium, with one thing at chemical equilibrium. And so this is axial distance, and the symbols again are the experimental data, and now the lines are from these calculations. And this is for CO2 and this is for CO. And there are clear discrepancies of places, but nevertheless, this is reproducing the fact that the maximum local extinction occurs here and the dependence upon the velocity. And no other method has been able to calculate any of this. Okay. So all I was going to show is some more results.
What mechanism of extinction? Why does
it is that mixing occurs more rapidly than combustion can make the fluid attain thermochemical equilibrium. If you have when you have a flame, I mean, the most important processes that are going on are reaction and molecular mixing. And in general, molecular mixing tends to pull the fluid away from equilibrium. Okay? If that process acts fast enough compared to reaction, it can pull it a long way away from equilibrium to the point where the reactions are no longer going on to any reasonable rate. And then you have extinction.
Cool. So isn't that cool?
We're assuming here that everything is adiabatic, which is a reasonable approximation for these flames. There is cooling by conduction. So conduction and molecular diffusion have the same kind of role.
Question about gradients. If I took a slice through your flame,
yes,
and looked at, say, the temperature and the density, because you pointed out that the density of the combustion products is 1/8. So what kind of gradients might I see in the average? You know, as I go through the velocity gradient, shear, in other words, what I'm really asking is, how does your code capture gradients? So what are the gradients, like, through a typical cross-section of the flame?
Of mean quantities?
Mean quantities, yes.
Well, this is what these profiles show. Those are radial profiles mm-hmm. of mean quantities. And here's the velocity.
What about temperature?
Okay. Keep patient. That's temperature.
They don't look like socks.
Well, but they're very steep. I mean, the question is, you know, how well is he resolving these in very important regions? That's really another question.
Well, I would characterize these as being very smooth. And, you know, we have 60 grids across here. Which is mm-hmm. enough. We know it's enough because we did very careful grid refinement studies. Statistically axisymmetric.
To use an axisymmetric grid?
Yes.
Can you get local quantities, like the structure of where it should occur?
Yeah, I mean, in any cell, at any location, we can go and interrogate this ensemble of particles and see how much is extinguished. Well, those scatter plots I've shown, we did the same way the experimentalists did. And what they do is they take all the data at a given axial location across the whole radius. And we did the same thing just to make comparisons. So it wouldn't be hard for us to go into a particular cell and figure out, as a function of radius also, what's going on. But we haven't done that. What you can't get from this is any information about instantaneous gradients or any two-point statistics. That's what you can't get.
Can you measure that? Any of that kind of information?
Yes, different people have done this, and this group is about moving towards that, and that is measuring along a line, so measure along the whole laser line. And in fact, but for less comprehensive measurements, people measure planar imaging. But you couldn't do that for all of these species.
How many particles total are you actually following? That's been
60 times 6,500, whatever that is.
Right. And do you have problems with the particles congregating in certain regions and being too sparse in other regions?
That is a very important consideration. If we were doing a plain constant density flow, then you can show from the equations that if you start with uniform particle number density, then you'll carry on having uniform particle number density. In fact, the mass density of the particles is basically proportional to the fluid density. And you can show all this just from the equations. And in fact, if you have a statistically axisymmetric flow, then your particle mass density will be proportional times r, the radius, times the mean density. So if you have light fluid near the axis, you don't have many particles. And so to have an accurate calculation, we have to have schemes of splitting particles to produce two particles of lower numerical weight. So we have numerical weights associated with our particles. So you know, there's a whole bunch of numerical tricks like that to make sure that the particle number density is more or less uniform. So the statistical error is the same everywhere. Okay, well, I've almost used up my hour, so I guess I should quit.
We started the 5 minute play, so assuming they can go on for at least 10 minutes.
Oh, I can? But I get on to it. Okay. Well, I'm not sure. Okay. I have the choice of showing more results or talking to about the computational implementation of the chemistry. Any preferences?
The latter. Yeah. Radicals.
Okay. Very important issue in this business is how you put in the chemistry. Now, one thing that has been learned over the years is that you cannot describe hydrocarbon chemistry in terms of one or two or three reactions. You have to have more. Maybe you need 16, say, something like that. So let's say 16 degrees of freedom in your system, okay? So you have some kind of detailed mechanism that describes that. And depending on the complexity of the fuel, we had methane, and maybe 16 would be enough. If you have more complicated fuels, you're going to need 100 species, even 1,000 species. And people have mechanisms involving 1,000 species. Okay?
Can you comment on how this conclusion was reached? Why so many are needed?
Different time scales.
Because no one succeeded in using fewer. Okay, I'm a strong believer in evolution and scientific progress. But it is really because you have these many different time scales, and the reaction rates change very much with temperature. So if you have temperature ranging from 300 Kelvin to 2500 Kelvin, which is the fastest reaction? Well, it may be a completely different one. You may have 20 reactions that become the fastest one in different temperature regimes. And then you have different stoichiometry. You may have a very fuel-rich mixture. You may have a very fuel-lean mixture. There's different chemistry taking place. Completely different reactions that dominate.
When we say nobody succeeded with less, succeeded to explain the experimental measurements. By doing
the full
simulation of chemistry which neglects hydrodynamics, for example.
Well, I'm not talking about neglecting hydrodynamics. I'm saying what is the fewest number of degrees of freedom you can have in a chemistry mechanism that can describe the whole range of combustion phenomena for a particular fuel. Okay? If you want to calculate a laminar premix flame propagating, then maybe you can do it with three or four reactions. But if you want to calculate ignition, extinction, non-premixed combustion, the whole range of phenomena, then experiences show that no one has been successful in doing that with less than 10 or 15 species.
But as you just demonstrated, understanding
finish the question when you understand hydrodynamics.
Sure.
If I don't have a good hydrodynamics model, I may decide that I'm not explaining the data because I have only 990 species and not 1,000. Are the reasons purely chemical? That is, they want to explain the appearance of 999 species which is observed in silk.
No, to start with, if you want to test the chemical mechanism, you wouldn't do it in a turbine flying. You do it in a laminar flying where things are much better understood. But secondly, what you can do, the way you get a reduced mechanism, or a way to get a reduced mechanism, you start with a detailed mechanism, and then you have a reduced mechanism. You can then test the reduced mechanism against the detailed mechanism, and that's sufficient to tell you whether it's accurate or not. So you don't need to worry about any other uncertainty. Okay. All right, so here we have the detailed description of the chemistry, and here we have CFD. Okay, we want to make calculations of laminar flames, we want to make calculations of turbine flows, turbine reaction flows using DNS or PDF methods, okay? So how do we get from here to here? If you put, you can imagine putting 100 species detailed mechanism in a DNS of turbulences, it's good if you're trying to sell computers, maybe, but... So you have to do something else, okay? So there are basically two things that you have to do, or two opportunities you have. One is to reduce the dimensions, okay? Reduce the number of degrees of freedom somehow. And the other thing to do is not to keep on doing expensive chemistry calculations over and over and over, but instead to have a storage retrieval system, like a tabulation system, where you calculate the chemistry once and then look it up. Okay? So the dimension reduction methodologies that people have worked on, there are these skeletal mechanisms where you just miss out species that you don't think are important, which is sort of okay but dangerous. There are systematic reduction mechanisms, which I won't talk about. But also there have been dynamical systems approaches which are much more interesting into figuring out how you can reduce the system. And the one that we developed is called intrinsic low-dimensional manifolds. And the idea is that if you have 100 species, you can think of yourself lying in a 100-dimensional space. The crucial observation is that if you go into these flames and make these scatter plots, and you plot these points in this 100-dimensional space, they will not fill the space. You will find all those points lie very close to a low-dimensional manifold of dimension maybe 10. And that's why I say you can get away with 10 degrees of freedom.
Okay. But that's a curved manifold of some sort. So the dynamics just quite a bit more complicated than I
do. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Well, in the work, the results that I showed you weren't based on this. They were based on one of these reduced mechanisms that started from a full mechanism with 50 species, and it was reduced to 16 species. Okay. So I want to talk about the second part, which is the tabulation. So here's the problem. Let's think of our PDF method, our particle method here. What we do is we separate reaction into a separate fractional step. Okay, we're marching in time. Our species evolves by reaction and mixing, so we just crudely split it up into a reaction step and a mixing step. In the reaction step, what we need to know is what we call the reaction mapping. Okay? Which all that is the composition at the end of that fractional step. Okay, so in other words, the composition at time t plus delta t, the end of the step, is this reaction mapping determined by the composition at the beginning of the step. Okay? How do you calculate this? Well, you just have to integrate the ordinary differential equations. Okay? Rate of change of composition equals the reaction rate. Okay, so this reaction rate is known. So you can figure out this reaction mapping just by integrating this ODE from the specified initial condition. Okay? The trouble is, if you were to do that for these calculations that I showed you, it would have taken about 7 years to do the computations. Okay, so we need a quicker way than this direct integration method. So we've devised this method called in situ adaptive tabulation to tabulate this reaction mapping as a function of the composition. So okay, so here's the idea. We want to tabulate this reaction mapping, and it's an n vector in n space, and let's say n is 20. How do you tabulate a 20-dimensional space? Well, you can't do it, right? There's no way you can tabulate the whole of a 20-dimensional space. If you want to do it with a structured table with 10 intervals in each direction, then you need 10 to the 20 cells, that, you know, which is too many. Okay? So how do we... So what's the solution? Well, as we've just discussed, the compositions that actually occur, which we call the access region of a composition space, lie close to a low-dimensional manifold, so we have some chance of tabulating it. However, that access region is not known a priori. Okay? We have this 20-dimensional space, and we don't know which region that is going to be accessed. So the solution to that is to build a table in situ for compositions that actually occur in the computation. So we start our PDF method calculation with an empty table, and as the computation goes along, we have particles with a given composition, and we just tabulate what we need for the particles that we actually have. Okay? So you can't set up the table as a pre-processing step, you have to do it in situ as the computation is going. As Chuck said, the manifold is not plane. Okay, it's going to be curved surface in this space, and this reaction mapping is highly nonlinear. That's the nature of combustion chemistry. So you have to use an unstructured adaptive tabulation technique, and we do this such that we can retrieve from this table with specified error tolerance. So roughly, the algorithm looks like this. Here's our CFD. Let's say it's our PDF particle method. We have all of these particles. Every time step for every particle, we want to know what the effective reaction is. So we send the initial composition to this ISAT algorithm. It has a table here, which is initially empty. It tries to retrieve the reaction mapping from the table. If it can't, it comes down here, it does the direct integration based on the detailed chemistry mechanism, returns the value, and also stores the information in the table, roughly speaking.
So these tables, what happens to them? Do they grow in size?
They grow.
What do you do? I mean, if you want to simulate for a long time, the table is too large to do anything. But then it gets cumbersome to look up in the table.
No. It's...
So what you're saying is the system is low dimensional, so actually the table doesn't blow up.
The table will grow, and in fact the table tends to continue to grow. Mm-hmm. The time to retrieve from the table isn't the issue, because it's a binary. It's stored in a binary tree, so it goes like the log of the number. Mm-hmm. So that's not a big deal. The storage is a big deal. Okay. So you have to stop building the table at some stage. And then you either just start building, and then in the rare event that you don't have what you need, you then do a direct integration. Or you can do the standard thing of throwing away the oldest table entry and replacing it with the new thing.
It might be interesting to check your table every now and then in case you go through a bifurcation where this manifold changes its shape. That would be interesting.
What fraction of steps do you generate?
Well, you see, this is when you first of all start out,
yeah.
You'll have to be.
Of course, but.
Well, I'll show you.
So is it just second order accurate?
Oh no! This is one of these. This is DASAC, one of these stiff ODE solvers, which written by Linda Petzold and other people. Now, these equations are very, very stiff, so you have to use the specially developed solvers for them. Okay, so this shows, this sort of answers your question, Brian. This is for a test problem. This shows the speed up achieved by this method against the number of queries. Now, each time we ask the table, that's a query, and the speed up is the time it would have taken just doing the direct integration divided by the time it actually took. Okay? So the number of queries here is 10 to the 10. Okay, so here's 10 to the 9. These are realistic numbers because you said how many particles we had in our Monte Carlo method, then you multiply by 2,000 time steps, and you get about a billion. Okay, so a billion times we have to do this chemistry calculation. And this shows the speed up, how the speed up evolves as the computation goes along. And by the end, we have a speed up of a factor of 1,000. For the PDF calculation I showed, it wasn't that impressive. The speed up may have been a factor of 50. Log plots are very deceiving because you look at your eye gives undue importance to the very early stage. Okay. This happens to be a test problem involving a zero-dimensional PDF method where you have 100 particles, just 100 particles, and in fact initially they all have the same state. Okay, so once you've calculated for the first particle, then you're just retrieving for the remaining 99. And so that gives you a very nice speed up, okay? But then you have to do some serious work when it becomes non-trivial.
Is this a parallel computation or just regular?
This is serial.
This is serial. But this is what I wanted to ask earlier. I mean, this is partly a Lagrangian method. Wouldn't it benefit quite a lot from a parallel implementation?
Oh, absolutely. The PDF calculations I showed you were done in parallel on just a cluster of Intel.
So, doable?
Yes. Oh. Well, why don't I stop then? I've gone over time.
It appears that hydrodynamics actually is treated in a very simple manner, yes, by this model for omega. So hydrodynamics is small part of the entire problem?
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with you. I mean, if you look at the hierarchy of turbulence models, if you go from sort of mixing length to K epsilon to Reynolds stress, what we're doing is above the Reynolds stress level. Right? Because we're representing the whole PDF of velocity. If you just look at the velocity. So it's a level higher than a Reynolds stress flowsheet. So it's obviously less computational work than LES or DNS.